This is the Tory Leadership Election Podcast, brought to you by Conservative Home.
Hello, and welcome back to this, the fifth episode of Conservative Home's Tory Leadership Election Podcasts. I'm sure you're all familiar with the drill by now, but for those of you who might have wandered in, having missed the earlier episodes, I'm joined by William Atkinson, our assistant editor, and the great Andrew Jimson, our sketch writer and book reviewer extraordinaire. We're going to be doing the same thing we do every week, which is sort of picking through the death march of this leadership election, touching on what's happened and how the candidates are faring, and has Rishi Sunak managed to turn things around yet? Spoilers, no. The format will be much the same. So what will happen first is that William will take us through the key dates for your diary in the week ahead. I'm assuming that this week he's actually taken the time to watch some of the hustings. Now Love Island is over. Then all three of us will pick through the meat of the week. And at the end, William will give us his winners and losers. And I'm minded to switch the format up a bit this year because we can't this week. Because I think if we just keep saying that Liz Truss has won and Rishi Sunak has lost, that might start getting rather repetitive, assuming that Rishi doesn't actually manage to win one week. But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. So without further ado, William, what lies ahead of us?
So I've got the dates for the next three hustings. The first is actually tonight, the 5th of August in Eastbourne, which, according to the internet, was the most bombed seaside town during the Second World War. Fact, fans. Then on the 9th, the race is moving to County Durham, to Darlington, more specifically, a seat that was won back by the Tories at the last election for the first time since 1992. And which also, according to the internet, is the current home of Dragon's Den star, I think former Dragon's Den star, Duncan Bannatyne, and the place of birth of Zoe Birkett, who was apparently a runner-up on Pop Idol, which was a programme before I was born. And then on the 11th, events switch to the Narm, Chelten Narm in particular, which is also home to 2,210 Grade 3 listed buildings. So what beautiful surroundings to have another leadership hustings in. But of course, the purpose of all of these hustings are for party members to make up their minds as to who to vote for between Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss. And we had the interesting news this week that GCHQ has stepped in to stop Tory members from being able to vote twice, basically suggesting that the system that CCHQ, don't get your CHQs mixed up, were using was vulnerable to attack, and therefore party members will no longer be able to vote twice. So I would therefore urge party members to take advantage of the various hustings that we're going to see going forward to help you make up your mind as to who our next Prime Minister should be, rather than just voting as soon as your ballot arrives. I know mine has arrived and I have yet to vote. I also know apparently the company that does the IT for CCHQ used to employ my father. And I would like to point out that my father has no relation to any Russian interference in this race whatsoever. But yes, so we've got three more hustings to look forward to in three places with very interesting facts available about each of them.
Right, there we go. Generation Z, keen pub quizzes, apparently. Is there anyone to whom you're not related? Actually, on that note, we mentioned we were going to try and book Taylor Swift. Now, I'm afraid we didn't manage to do that. We almost did. The diaries didn't quite work out because she insisted that Andrew do one of her sellout stadium shows in exchange. And sadly, he couldn't quite fit that in. But we almost got there. So I feel like we did point out that this double vote thing from CCHQ was going to be an absolute recipe for chaos, but I don't know how much points you should really get for being relentlessly cynical about an organisation that doesn't work very well. But we did say it would happen in, I think, week two, and lo and behold, it has come to pass. So make of that what you will. So this week, William, I believe I actually charged you with watching one of the hustings, given that that is sort of our purpose. Well, what did you make of it? Because this is the first one you've seen. I've seen about four of them now, God help me. But what did you make of the one that you saw? Which one was it?
I saw last night, the Sky hustings. I caught up on it after going to an excellent BBC prom with Shostakovich. But I made sure to take up and watch it afterwards. I thought it was interesting because the audience were nominally sort of undecided Tory members. And in the end, again, spoiler alert, they ended up being very heavily for Sunak. And I think certainly from what I saw, Sunak did the better performance. He was more willing perhaps to take on the harder questions of party members, whereas Truss looked quite flustered, for example, when she was asked by either Kay Burley about whether she would remove the whip from Boris Johnson and post the Standards investigation. Or also there were some slightly dicey questions on foreign policy, which I think as that's her area of expertise, I think she handled relatively well, but it was nice to see her challenged on it because, you know, people like me are slightly sceptical of her approach both to Ukraine and Taiwan. But also, actually, I think defence spending was the area where Sunak struggled the most as well, because you have Ben Wallace obviously backing Liz Truss, and as our survey has shown, he's a very popular cabinet minister, seen to have done very well over the crisis in Ukraine. And he says one of his reasons for backing Truss is because she wants to see defence spending to rise to 3% of GDP. So it was very easy for a party member to turn around and say to Sunak, well, why won't you do this too, especially as we're seeing Putin's horrific actions in Ukraine. But I thought actually Sunak's answer on that was quite good, which he says, I'm not going to go for an arbitrary figure. And also he's already backed the biggest increase in defence spending since the Cold War. So I did think it was perhaps a Sunak victory. But as you say, with all the polls suggesting, and of course the gold standard of the Conholm survey suggesting this as well, that Truss is at least 30 points ahead, it's rather a Pyrrhic victory, I would suggest.
This is one of the things about Truss's campaign is that, you know, she's already backed Northern Powerhouse Rail. She's backed tens of millions of pounds in unfunded tax cuts, or billions of pounds in unfunded tax cuts, I should say. And now we're getting defence spending commitments and everything else. And the entire economic proposition from Team Truss is just getting less and less plausible. Now, I mean, I think there's big black marks on the Rishi Sunak side of the ledger in that, personally, I worry that he wouldn't really respond fast enough to the cost of living crisis we're going to have in October. He's very sort of treasury-brained. I think that the sheer scale of what's going to need to be done would probably have to be dragged out of him in a way that would be politically quite damaging, which is slightly ironic given that he was the chancellor who made his name with whatever it takes during the pandemic. But yeah, no, that was the Sky debate was just slightly, it was a reminder of his strengths. He's a much more polished performer, and with the exception of some of these slightly flaily efforts to win over the grassroots in recent weeks, his general offer is much more cogent. It's simply a question of whether or not it would actually win in a general election, let alone a vote of Conservative members. Andrew, have you watched any of these?
Yes, well, I feel coming to these podcasts each week, I feel rather like a rather backward piano pupil who hasn't done any practice. And you're the teacher who will frown. I watched the same thing last night. I did some last minute practice.
Okay.
And I certainly thought Sunak was, I think it's a really horrible format, sort of trying to tell everyone I'm better than anyone else. And there's inevitably a big element of cakeism in the answer. You can have your cake and eat it. I think that's a feature not only of Boris Johnson's approach to politics, but of democratic politics, actually. That's what we half want to believe, or in fact completely want to believe.
One point I would make on that, actually, is Andrew, yes. Mentions, of course, the format. I don't think it's a particularly good format, because Sky made a very big thing about the fact that both candidates had flipped a coin before the start of the event to work out who could go first. But Sunak apparently lost the coin flipping, but took excellent advantage of the fact that he was going second. I think, isn't it, that in is it Julius Caesar, the Shakespeare play, where whoever is it, Brutus goes first, and then Octavian, or whatever he's called at that point, goes second. And as a consequence, you can respond to everything that the first person has said. And Sunak was very good on that, because Truss, basically responding to the big news this week about interest rate rises, etc., said that she thought a recession could be averted, and that it could be done so in a manner that didn't involve further interest rates hikes, etc. Whereas Sunak sort of responded to that and said, no, inflation is the big issue that we must tackle immediately. The audience seemed to respond quite well to that.
Well, I mean, I suppose someone has to go first, given the linear nature of time.
Right? Well, but I think it was the fact that Sky thought it was a better thing to go first, whereas actually I think it's probably that if you were flipping a coin to go first, actually that's probably a coin flip you want to lose.
Didn't Truss choose to go first?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. So she...
Well, that was a tactical mistake by Truss.
Yeah.
To go with her proposal to slash pay in the regions for millions of public sector workers who vote Conservative, which I suppose we should touch on, because that was sort of the big wobble of the week, wasn't it? This plan for regional pay boards from the Truss campaign that sort of came and went.
Yes, and she wasn't really entirely candid about the whole thing. and so annoyed a lot of the reporters who had reported.
Well, this is a really interesting one because if you look at what happened, you can see the gap they fell into because the actual proposal in the press release only applied to new hire civil servants. But they tacked onto the press release a savings figure, which would only happen if you applied it to teachers and nurses and everything else. Now, you can see how this happened in the guts of the campaign, which is they came up with this policy, they sent it off to whoever it was who was putting the press release together, and they reached for the biggest available number in the file and sent it out. But it does mean that you can't really put out a thing saying we're going to save however many billions over X period, which the number you can only get by sacking nurses or whatever it is they were proposing, not sacking, cutting the pay of public servants, and then claim that you're not doing that. But Rishi Sunak, I don't think, managed to capitalise effectively. I don't know what you guys think, but he went with the U-turn line. Now, if you're in the bubble like us, and Liz Truss is obviously cosplaying as Margaret Thatcher, getting her for, you know, the lady is for turning is obviously very satisfying. But I think that Rishi had a much stronger counterattack, which was, I put the Treasury in Darlington and I'll pay them properly as well. But he didn't go on the substance. Again, yes. He went on the show.
And he hasn't really done blood, toil, tears and sweat. And that is, in a way, I think he should double down on it. It is actually going to be bloody difficult, this forthcoming recession. Interest and inflation at 13%. I mean, that's a hell of a thing. And it's come up very suddenly, actually. And it's not going to be easy. And I think sort of somehow pretending that the government can completely ameliorate it is wrong. I mean, we can get through it and we can prosper after it. But I thought Rishi had definitely won last night, and he's the underdog now. And in some ways that's an easier position to be in than the front runner who, and people love a contest. So maybe he will start to make up some ground, but he's not making the most of his actually more solid and realistic case, I don't think.
No, I mean, I thought it was interesting this week that he got endorsed by Nigel Lawson, who was Margaret Thatcher's chancellor. And Lawson was basically saying Margaret Thatcher did not cut taxes when we needed to get inflation down. In fact, her early budgets had quite a lot of very strict tax rises. And it was only when that was done, when that spade work had been done, that we were able to pivot to, I suppose you could call it, sort of the late Thatcherite tax-cutting agenda. And instead he's sort of presenting Liz Truss as Anthony Barber.
Yes.
Who set off the barber boom and then probably sunk the Heath government.
Yes.
So
Truss will have a barber figure because Barber was just, I mean, obviously Ian McLeod had died and Barber was put in by Heath to do his bidding.
You can imagine, can't you? So you put in a new chancellor, you announce all of these tax cuts, you're momentarily very popular.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden these tax cuts get completely eaten up by inflation and you're having to cut public services and you end up worse than you were before.
Well, I think this is the point I made in my editorial this morning about Trustonomics. I was slightly annoyed because, of course, when Andrew and I did our excellent interview with Liz Truss last week, and she told us how important growth was to her, I just had in mind Barber's Dash for Growth and the idea we were going back to the world of sort of chancellors announcing inflationary but growth-orientated budgets throughout the 60s and 70s and then having to deal with the consequences 12 months later. That's what really struck me about her proposals when we were interviewing her. But I think that the more important point is that, yes, I think actually on the fundamental economics, you know, Lawson and Sunak are right that inflation is a cancer that disrupts and eats away at economies and it must be dealt with however hard it is to do so. That's the lesson of the 70s and 80s. But the problem is that we had a Conservative government barely elected, of course, didn't actually get a majority in 2010 on a pitch of making the hard choices because it was required in the national interest. And that was 12 years ago. And since then, we've seen the Brexit referendum, which went towards the change option. We've seen the 2017 general election where the Tories lost their majority and very almost lost the election entirely to the change option in Jeremy Corbyn. And then in 2019, Boris Johnson managed to pose as the change option and managed to win a majority of 80. So whoever is going to win this contest, if they're then going to be forced into saying we must wear the economic hair shirt, whether that's Sunak through choice or Truss through circumstance, that's not really going to be a pitch that the public, I think, is looking for. However awful the economic climate is, they've been asking for change now for at least 6 years. And the problem is that we're not offering that. We're offering more harsh medicine. And it strikes me the Tories can make the right decisions on the economy. They can call for interest rates to be raised. They can try to reduce borrowing, etc. But if the country is fundamentally not ready for that message, then we're going to lose whatever happens in 2023, 2024.
Or, you know, this is the alternative with Truss, is that she actually manages to limp over the line in 23 or 24, and then we have an absolutely miserable 5 years, you know, limping through most of the rest of this decade with a small majority, absolutely atrocious economic headwinds and no public support.
If you remember, though, Truss was one of the few people who has managed to convert to Toryism in the dying days of the major government in 1997. So maybe she'll be acting out the same career path as her idol.
She's one of the five people to whom John Major won over to the party after 92. Although he did get the highest popular vote in history, we should point out. I think this is one of the things that's really struck me about this week with the inflation stuff, is this is the first time I've properly got a sense of what it must have been like being in British politics in the 60s and 70s. Because there are just an awful lot of bad economic headwinds that are exacerbated by really deep structural problems with how the British state is organized. And all of those problems are really popular, so you can't do anything about them. Now, obviously, they're not what they were. You know, in the 60s and 70s, you're mostly talking about things like nationalization, overmighty trade unions, and capital controls, and so on. Whereas now, really, we're talking about planning. We're talking about the fact that our public services are organized on a very inefficient basis. You know, the NHS is, in terms of public spending, if not overall spending, is a very expensive way of delivering middling care. We've got unsustainable pensions that people think they've paid into, even though they haven't, because they keep voting, as you said, for having their cake and eating it. And yet, you can't really see what a politician who wants to be elected does about any of this. Both neither Truss nor Rishi Sunak are prepared to propose building houses on the Greenbelt. Neither of them are prepared to propose cracking down on multiple home ownership or anything that would help supply. Liz Truss, I think, is proposing to increase the amount that people can borrow, which will help in the very short term. But then all that will happen eventually is that the market will realise there's a vast sum of money about to be pumped into it, and you know, prices will equalise upwards. And so I don't see a way out at the moment. You know, Margaret Thatcher was only possible, and maybe yes, one of you two will disagree, Margaret Thatcher was only possible once things got so bad that yes, the public was prepared, or at least 45% of the public yes, was prepared to elect a government that would pick these fights.
Yes,
I don't think there's a 45% of the public prepared to go after planning reform or major public sector reform or, you know, any of the stuff that actually needs to happen to get Britain growing. I don't know if either of you dispute this thesis.
I think probably that's right. Things were felt much worse in the 70s because Heath had his U-turn. He had all this preparation in the 60s, enormous policy preparation, but no analysis of what to do about inflation. And so then the U-turn and prices and incomes and stuff, and the ill-picked fight with the miners' defeat. Who governs Britain? Not you, Ted. But then the Labour were defeated as well. And of course, their social contract almost immediately with the unions again almost immediately broke down. So that was very, very humiliating period. I mean, I quite like the 3-day week because I'm very fond of candles. But
as journalists, we're familiar with 3-day weeks.
But it was a period of real national humiliation. We haven't had that.
Well, I think the interesting thing is, of course, is that in terms of actual time that the Tories have been in government, we're comparable to, say, the Churchill, Eden, Macmillan, and then Douglas Hume governments in the time that we've actually been in power, what, with 12 years, and onto our fourth leader. But actually, in terms of the sort of economic problems we confront, as I say in my editorial this morning, we do increasingly, say, resemble the situation in the early 70s. But I think the problem was is that over a 20-year period, successive governments had to be seen to fail to deal with the essential problems of the day: sclerotic industry, national decline, out-of-control trade unions, and, of course, inflation. You had, you know, Wilson with In Place of Strife, and then Heath, you know, defeated by the miners and then defeated by inflation. Who governs Britain? Not you, mate. And then Wilson sort of driven out by his own sort of inadequacy. And then finally Callaghan smashed against the rocks of the winter of discontent before the public was actually willing to go for the radical change that Mrs. Thatcher offered. And even then, of course, Thatcher, John Hoskins, Geoffrey Howe, etc., had an actual plan for actually trying to bring inflation down, deal with the fundamental problems of this country. And I think we're really not in that place. The country hasn't actually seen, you know, the evil that inflation can do, the evil that all of these problems can do. And I think, you know, we're going to see another 5-10 years of governments failing to deal with these problems, these fundamental problems, before actually there's the will there. And actually the planning behind a particular, probably Tory leader, because we're better at dealing with the country's fundamental problems than Labour are, willing to actually sort of plan out and strategize how we can reform these fundamental problems of the British state.
I think we should talk about Labour briefly, because one of the things that, you know, there is now a realistic proposition that we lose the next election, to put it very mildly, when it didn't really look like it was last year. But the interesting thing is that Labour don't really seem to have a vision, really. I couldn't tell you what it is, and nor could most Labour-facing journalists that I've spoken to. There's no grand plan. There's no unifying theory that Starmer has for fixing the country's ailments. You know, he stands there at PMQs and he demands that Boris Johnson meet with the trade unions about the railways, for example. But I don't know what Labour would do with such a meeting. Would they capitulate? I mean, are they just going to pay all of these in sort of above inflation pay rises and vastly increase the public sector pay bill? Are they going to raise taxes to pay for that? Which taxes? And it's very difficult to see how Labour can, and a lot of these things that we're dealing with are of course Labour's sacred cows, much of the public sector. In theory, a sufficiently ruthless Labour government could start paving the home counties. Because it could basically just say, you know, if a constituency has a Tory or Liberal Democrat MP, good luck to you. We're building council houses here now. But they don't seem to be doing that either. And of course, if they actually end up forming a government, they'll do that by winning a lot of voters who will have the same prejudices that much of our electorate does. So again, I think we talk about having a miserable few years in government. I think if Labour win, Labour have an absolutely miserable few years in government as well. I don't really see how it turns out particularly well for them either.
Well, I think that's right. Obviously, they don't want to interrupt the Tories while the Tories are perhaps making a mistake, but there isn't. There is absolutely no feeling that there's no sense of direction, really. I mean, apart from having their own internal battle to defeat the Corbynistas, which obviously has been a bitter battle fought ward by ward and constituency by constituency, and has consumed a great deal of Labour energy, there isn't. I mean, Keir Starmer is a relatively inexperienced politician. He spent his life as a successful lawyer. And he doesn't, I don't think he has, mind you, of course, my favourite quotation about politics, Herzen in 1850, on the whole, modern man has no solutions. But I don't think the Labour Party, it doesn't convey a feeling that this would be a new dawn, a new, certainly, obviously not 1945, but not...
Not 97.
Why, no, I think 97 either.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things about Starmer, of course, is how uninteresting he is. I think one reason why for the last few months, alas, now over, I've been much more interested in, say, Love Island than Prime Minister's Questions is because at least there's some sort of excitement to it. Whereas seeing sort of Boris turn up and give his usual sort of speech and bluster and then Starmer respond by being incredibly bland, it's not necessarily the most exciting thing to watch. But yes, I think the most likely scenario at the moment of the next general election is probably a hung parliament, which because the Tories over the last 12 years have managed to hiss off all of their potential allies, means that it's much more likely we have a Labour government propped up in some form by the Lib Dems and the SNP. And we backed the situation, again, basically, of the 74 to 79 Labour governments under Wilson and Callaghan, which either had a tiny little majority or no majority whatsoever, sort of forced to continually horse trade with smaller parties and dealing with these huge fundamental problems, but unable to actually do anything to actually tackle them. There is, despite what we hear about both Blair and Brown and Mandelson playing quite a big role behind the scenes in the current Labour setup, there's no actual planning, there's no actual interest in doing big radical things in government. It's simply a focus on making themselves sufficiently untoxic and that they might be able to squeak across the line next time.
With the exception of perhaps of Gordon Brown's ongoing efforts to deliver a radical constitutional policy that will somehow vindicate the massive mistakes that he made in 1998, and the prospect of, if you want the UK to stay together, I think the prospect of a Labour government propped up by the SNP in the current environment should fill you with dread. But on that cheery note, I'm going to bring this section of the podcast to a close. There's only so much doom and gloom one can do in 1 week, and it's a nice day outside, and the sunshine is free, so we can go out and enjoy it in just a moment. But before we do, it is time for everyone's favourite segment, William's Winners and Losers. Who are they this week?
Do you know, the winner for this week, Henry, perhaps surprisingly, is Liz Truss. And despite the fact, you know, there's an obvious caveat, she faced the terrifying trifecta of that huge stumble over regional pay, which was then brought up in last night's Sky event. The fact that she had to U-turn on it within about 15 hours because of a half-thought-out press release basically suggests that the wonks in her team had slightly misthought of what both the Tory party membership and the commentariat were looking for from a Truss government. And then also there's the fact that Sunak, I think, did clearly do much better in the Sunak events. And then finally, you know, my concerted attack on Trussonomics and my editorial this morning, I'm sure, had the Truss campaign fleeing in terror through my my comparisons on Anthony Barber, etc. But despite all of this, both our poll, our survey, I should say, and YouGov's poll have put in more than 30 points clear. And frankly, with the most recent YouGov poll suggesting that only about, say, 10, 12% of party members are currently undecided. And now with Sunak losing the opportunity to have people vote twice based on GCHQ's manoeuvrings, it looks like Truss is, again, the overwhelming favourite to be our next Prime Minister. And now I think Tory MPs, especially from what we hear and what they say, are thinking more about who's going to be where in the next cabinet than they are about whether Rishi Sunak might be the person who is first among equals. But of course, we can't illustrate a good week without doing a bad week. And don't worry, listeners, I'm not going to say Rishi Sunak, however obvious that would be. But instead, I'm going to say a person who's had a bad week is Sajid Javid, who came out this week to back Liz Truss. Now, remember, Sajid, before the actual voting even began, had to drop out of this Tory leadership race after being the first person to resign and set in motion Boris Johnson's defenestration. He then laid out a series of policy proposals, I think over about 25 pages, which had various radical solutions as to how this country should be reformed and how growth can be increased, houses built, and motherhood and apple pie given to all who wanted it. But now it seems that Javid has thought more about A, getting back into the cabinet, and B, backing the person who most resembles his economic perspectives by coming out to back Truss. Now, there was a lot of talk about the fact that both, you know, him and Sunak resigned within 10 minutes of each other. They were previously together at the Treasury, and they're both known to be Star Wars buddies. But he has long been a supporter of a similar economic prospectus to that of Truss, e.g. backing greater borrowing and tax cuts. Now, that might have been a viable economic sort of prospectus about 2 or 3 years ago, when it looked like interest rates were going to remain low for long for a long time, and we were in a country that still looked to be growing, however anemically. But now, as we're looking a recession in the face, and inflation is, according to the Bank of England, set to hit 13%. Now, a month ago, it was saying it would hit 10%. I've been saying, not to show off too much, since about March or April, that it's going to hit 15% and go beyond, and I haven't been dissuaded by that from Andrew Bailey's comments yesterday. That sort of policy prospectus just looks hugely economically unrealistic at the moment and would not only be inflationary, but it wouldn't tackle the exact problems that the economy currently has. And now I'd like to point out that, of course, appointing Andrew Bailey as head of the Bank of England was pretty much the only thing Sajid Javid did in his few months as Chancellor of the Exchequer, which perhaps suggests that his economic judgment is not too sound. And so whilst the Truss campaign might be touting his backing as a good thing, it perhaps suggests they haven't entirely got their ideas together when it comes to dealing with the economic crisis this country is currently staring in the face.
I mean, that's quite... I almost feel that I should have been Sunak, because that's very savage, basically saying that Sajid Javid is a loser by dint of being himself and his record for the past few years rather than any misfortune that's befallen him this week. But I suppose that is true. I have to say I have a soft spot for him because he's the only candidate who actually came out and said, yes, we do actually need to build houses. And then this being the Conservative Party, his campaign immediately imploded. But, you know, big love for Sajid Javid from the Con Home podcast, it has to be said. And on that note, we're going to call it here for today. We will be back next week, probably with the editor in tow, I think. We can never be entirely sure when he's going to return, but it's always a pleasure when he does. So until then, it's goodbye from me, it's goodbye from William, and it's a fond farewell, hopefully au revoir rather than farewell, to Andrew Jimson, and we will see you next week.